Harold Koh, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
So you've had such a distinguished career in international law, and I really just kind of wanted to start with a general discussion about what that is, what international law is. Many people struggle with this concept. They consider international law to be a violation of state sovereignty, that international law is weak and that it can't be enforced, that it's really a reflection of the interests of powerful states, that it's really, you know, doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's not worthwhile. What would you say to somebody who's a skeptic about international law?
What it does is it sets up a patterns of conduct that we follow and that people expect to be followed. So it gives a kind of certainty to life. To just give an example, when I was a student, if you went to Europe, you couldn't be sure that if you lost your luggage, you'd get paid. When you got to the other side, you had to have traveler's checks. If you had a visa for one country, it didn't get you into another country. There are no communications mechanisms that allowed you to let your family know where you were. International law has freed us in remarkable ways to do remarkable things. We now have luggage protection under the Warsaw Convention. Electronic funds transfers allow you to draw money from ATM machines, the Schengen visas that allow you to travel all across Europe. So it's an enormously liberating thing. And, you know, now I think what people are concerned about is we're part of these networks, so people who are also part of these networks have influence over us. My answer to that is, so we're part of a legal network. We're also part of an economic network. We're part of a cultural network. We're interdependent with the rest of the world. We have influence over them. They have influence over us. So why should we build this structure and make it stronger? Because it's the thing that gives us the most capacity to control the future in a common destiny. And I think the most important thing is that the United States is a country that, when it was a small nation, tried to win the respect of the world by talking about its faithfulness to international law. The Declaration of Independence says, out of a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, we understood at that time that if we didn't follow the rules on piracy or war, we would be isolated. So we followed international law. That's what small countries do. And I think if we want to continue to be a global leader, we have to play by the global rules. I mean, if you think about it this way, if you ask how should we talk to China, you say, if you want to be a global leader, be a part of the global system and play by the global rules. And that's all that we're being asked to do reciprocally.
Well, it's very interesting to hear you talk about the very practical aspect. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize these kind of day-to-day things like luggage and financial transfers are practical aspects of international law. But you've gone further, and of course, in your many books and articles and the work that you've done, to talk about transnational jurisprudence and international law as a critical for order in the international system, and that concepts like, you know, that we hold dear in this country, liberty, equality, privacy, are not just American ideas, but are part of a global human rights movement. So it's not just about practicality and engagement, you know, in kind of day-to-day business and travel and communications and the way in which we live our lives, but that there's something deeper to it than that. And you were kind of alluding to it when you were saying, you know, as far as global leadership and being, you know, setting the standard as kind of global leader, that international law is a requirement for that. But it's deeper than that, isn't it? I mean, you've written, it seems to me, that there's something more that would indicate, you know, in order for us to spread liberty, equality, privacy, those kinds of ideas, international law is a requirement.
So just to give an example, nearly 60 years ago in Brown versus the Board of Education, our Supreme Court said that segregated schools are not equal. Separate but equal is inherently unequal. So if another country, say South Africa, were addressing the same question under their constitution, and the question is this equal protection or equal treatment, you would expect them to look at what another country addressing the same set of issues did 50 years earlier. Why do you want to be ignorant of a relevant precedent just because it's not from your own system? You're not bound to follow it, but it's good to know. So a lot of this is simply the statement that various issues have been addressed by different systems For example, I learned, to my surprise, that gays and lesbians were admitted to the military publicly of Germany in 1969. So they have 43 years of experience with it before we finally address that question. One of the things that people were saying, as a matter of fact, was that having gays and lesbians in the military would disrupt the cohesiveness of military units. It turned out that American soldiers have been serving alongside German troops in NATO forces who are gay. So nobody said that those units aren't cohesive. So it's a way to test factual claims that are made to see whether they're based on any fact. Or let me give you another example. Our Constitution forbids cruel and unusual punishments. But up until quite recently, a number of states of the Union allowed the execution of people whose IQs were less than 80 and who therefore have mental retardation. And there's a lot of research done on this. We learned that there were only two countries in the world out of 193 that permitted the execution of people with mental retardation, the United States and Kyrgyzstan. And so a brief was filed at the Supreme Court that said this is an unusual situation, at which point Kyrgyzstan filed a brief in which they said, we've stopped doing this. It's only the United States. And within the United States, it turned out that only about 20 states had this law in the books and only about 5 had actually used the law ever. So our Constitution says no cruel and unusual punishment. If we're the only country in the world that does it out of 193, and in fact, if only about 5 states of our 50 states do it, that's unusual. And it seems to me that that's what our Constitution anticipated, that something becomes unusual, you question whether it's constitutional.
And international law is obviously helpful for that in terms of putting it in context in a global environment.
Well, I see international law as quite simply about the advance of civilization at various levels. When states are in a state of nature, they deal with each other through force and threats. As they start to cooperate, they create communal relationships. Sometimes those relationships are set forth in norms and rules or agreements, just like a neighborhood agreement in a condominium complex. So if people have resort to these rules and dispute resolution mechanisms, it avoids them fighting. And it's a way in which you essentially have a kind of law that governs the community. That seems to me is putting your ingenuity on behalf of creating structures to avoid conflict. If after all these years we haven't been able to develop such mechanisms, then we haven't advanced much. Now, just because we have them doesn't mean that they're straitjackets or that they can make us do things that are counterproductive or dangerous. But certainly it's worth the effort to try to have such rules.
Well, on that note, I have to ask about a specific case that you've commented upon. In 2010, in fact, you gave a speech where you strongly supported the legality of drone strikes. I mean, as we're talking about advancement of civilization and an avoidance of conflict, you came out suggesting that drone strikes for targeted killings in places like Pakistan and Yemen and others where it's a part of that global war on terror is legal and just, I suppose. And so how do you square that around with what you were just saying regarding advancement of civilization and avoidance of conflict? How do you separate those two things? Help us understand that.
Yeah, so there are three key points. Number one, not all wars are between nation states. What happened on September 11th was the start of an armed conflict between the United States and a non-state actor, Al-Qaeda. And it's a transnational organization. So that requires some translation of the laws of war to this new situation. Number two, the history of warfare is using more and more remote weapons more and more precisely. So at the beginning, there's face-to-face combat. Then you had bows and arrows and then spears and then catapults and then bombs. And now we have drones, which strike with tremendous accuracy. My point was that these are not per se illegal. They could be used lawfully. So I think if you use one to kill Osama bin Laden, that would be lawful. If you use it to kill a child, that's unlawful. So what determines whether it's lawful or not is what rules you apply and follow. The third question, after all, Many people defend the use of the nuclear weapons, which are by their nature extremely indiscriminate and always kill civilians because they just can't be controlled in that way. Drones could, in theory, be a much more accurate and humane and lawful way to conduct conflict. The final question goes to Al-Qaeda. You know, it seems to me that we're not at war with most of the people of the Middle East. Arab Spring gives us a chance to reach out to their hearts and minds and try to persuade them to join us in some different kind of exercise. But there's going to be a group of people, and Osama bin Laden is one of them, who don't want to be Democrats. He didn't want to be the leader of a country. His job was designing bombs and weapons to kill innocent civilians. And the response against him was in the context of the laws of war. And I think that if drones end up achieving that outcome, I don't like that, but I don't think it's illegal. As a lawyer, I would say that's a lawful use of drones.
So to relate that and connect that then, as you were just making this point about using these types of technology to protect innocent civilians, to protect others, those to target and get rid of those who are dangerous to other people, if I'm hearing you correctly. Can we connect that at all to this larger issue of the responsibility to protect and to engage in humanitarian intervention? And if so, why is this so difficult for us to deal with this issue, you know, in terms of engaging, whether it's in Syria or, you know, in Darfur or wherever it is? Why is this so difficult for us, this concept of responsibility to protect, if it's lawful, as you're saying? I mean, because just because it's lawful, I guess, doesn't mean that we will do it.
Yes. Well, it used to be we were just limited by our physical capacities. There was a time when even if we'd wanted to do something across the other side of the world, we couldn't do it, or we couldn't get our military assets over to where they needed to be. Now, since you have the capacity, the question is when do you have a responsibility? Now, I'm struck, for example, in Syria, many people talk about a pro-peace position as not intervening. Not intervening means a war continues and that innocents get slaughtered. So to do nothing is to let war continue. Now, then the question is, can you satisfy the principle of first do no harm? Is it possible, together with other countries, to use military action to prevent slaughter from occurring? I think this was brought to a head when there was a clear and undeniable attack on children with chemical weapons. Now, some people say, well, look, the UN Charter says you cannot violate territorial sovereignty because of a if there's no Security Council resolution because the Russians have vetoed it. If that were an absolute rule, then every country that had veto could commit genocide in its own territory and there'd be nothing you could do about it. The UN system values more than just territorial sovereignty. It values human rights. It values peace and security. So I think we need to look at this issue going forward. It's obviously in a state of flux, but I think just asserting an absolute rule doesn't make any sense. Finally, there are people who say it's legitimate, but it's illegal to do humanitarian intervention. I would say that when the ERA failed, did we say it's illegal but legitimate to want to have equal rights for women? You keep pushing that until you get to a better legal rule.
Well, certainly very interesting and a lot for us to think about. Harold Koh, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.